This is user error. We're never done fucking around.
No, that's true. It's constantly. I deeply hate selecticize. I deeply hate it. It has been forced upon us. It is an inferior product, and it's so excruciatingly annoying when you go to rip off a paper towel and you get half the paper towel you want. And then they ram it down our throats.
Growing up, my mom let me use her home as an ice rink. She just grabbed the Bounty Selecticize. One Selecticize sheet of Bounty is 50% more absorbent than a full-size sheet of the leading ordinary brand. Use less with Bounty Selecticize.
Get it out of here.
This, have you seen this? You can't buy paper towels now that aren't Selecticize. They're all, and they have pick a size, select a size, choose a size, small size, hand size, fun size. And so it's the standard paper towel roll, but they've cut the paper towel in half, and it's they call it Selecticize. And it's the worst product ever. And then just over a period of 5 years, the whole industry has moved to Selecticize.
So do you think you're in the minority, or do you think, like, is this they're doing it, or they're just no customer feedback?
No, I feel like the sales must drive them.
You would hope.
But who's buying paper towels and wants them to be less effective? Who wants less of a paper towel? Nobody wants that. Nobody wants less effective paper towels.
See, I think I'm actually in the Selecticize camp.
No.
I was pretty happy when they first came around because I was using more paper towel than I need. And it's rare that I use a paper towel for a big spill because I have, like, hand towels and other like rags in my house.
Or a mop,
yeah.
Yeah, I just...
But so, I do agree there are those times
where
you want...
What are you using a paper towel for then? Just to dry off your hands? See, that's where I use a standard towel, and it's like the big spills, I go for the paper towel because that stuff, I'm ejecting it from the spaceship out the airlock the moment I'm done cleaning that mess up.
Well, see, Chris, you use it for the little spills, and then you select the size for that spill.
I think they've got Tariqai.
I hate you!
We can't trust him anymore. We didn't trust him to start with, but that's
it.
Fine.
I hate Selecticize with a passion. And we go out in the grocery store and we try to find non-Selecticize. You can't find it anymore.
You should just switch to those like intense, heavy-duty shop towels they have at Costco.
No, and then... you know, actually, this is how much I hate these, is we actually have gone to restaurant supply stores.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Where they have more commercial-grade like supplies and bought the commercial-grade paper towels that are our standard size. But even those are getting weakened. They're a weakened product.
Chris, you are... a crazy, crazy man. I've never even noticed this stuff.
Your house is either filthy or impeccably clean based on what you've just said.
Why does it matter so much?
It is every time I peel it off, it's like getting kicked in the nuts.
Can't you just like peel off extra though?
That's where I'm at. Like, I don't have the intermediate. If it's a really big spill, I'm going to need multiple of it anyway, and I kind of just keep rolling in the roll.
Yeah, you know what I like to do with the paper? I like a full paper towel because I don't want something that damages the structural integrity of the paper towel right in the middle. Because when I go to rip off the paper towel, I want the whole square, not like a half rectangle or whatever. And what I like to do is I like to get my hands nice and clean, right? And then they're all wet. And I like to take a full paper towel. And of course, I got wet, drippy hands, so I don't want to be dripping all over stuff. And I don't really want to grab like a lot of stuff to try to make sure I get the right size, because then I get the main paper towel roll wet, and that pisses me off. So what I want to do is I want a quick grab and swipe, and I get a full paper towel, not a half paper towel. I dry my hands off. The paper towel is a little damp after that, and then I can rub my face with a nice, wet, soft paper towel, and I kind of clean my face at the same time because I just dried my clean hands. And then, I can, like, toss that away. And it's the perfect size for that, and they have fundamentally wrecked the primary use of paper towels for me.
I feel like you just, like, contradicted yourself here, though, because you said that you use a towel to dry your hands and not paper towel.
Depends if I'm doing dishes versus, like, washing my hands after going outside.
But
like,
if you're doing dishes, why do you need to clean your face?
Well, no, because if I'm washing my hands...
The grease gets everywhere.
No, if I'm doing dishes, I use a towel, because otherwise I'd be going through a whole roll of paper towels.
See, that seems... totally backwards to me.
No, because otherwise you gotta.
If I'm washing my hands, I'd use the towel.
See, I have a couple of towels that are set aside for drying dishes and the whatnots, because I don't have a dishwasher in the RV. And then I have paper towel rolls that are set aside for, like, I just came in, I got mud all over my hands and stuff. And that's where the paper towels come in. Or like a spill, like, you know.
You know how to solve your problem. You just air dry your dishes and use the towels in the bathroom.
You know, guys, it's coming up on the holidays, and there's a conversation that we really need to have. It's not easy, it's not always fun, and it should happen probably every year. You got to talk to your family about security.
Yeah, or they're going to ask you at least.
They're going to ask you.
Yeah, that's always, because I'm the tech guy. Chris is the tech guy of the family.
Can you fix it? Just fix it already.
Yeah,
come on.
Can you take a look at this while you're here? Because, you know, you're here for a free, delicious holiday meal. So can you just take a look at my computer? What am I supposed to say?
Can you find out why my Wi-Fi is so slow?
I have like this. I only support Linux systems.
See, that's great.
Yeah, but then when I'm over there and they're cooking like two turkeys and it's like, and they're also feeding my kids. Like,
or they're going the extra mile and frying a turkey.
Yeah, so I thought, I've been seeing this go around. We're not the first ones to come up with this, but I thought we could do our take on this. The top 10 holiday guide of what you're going to fix for your family when you go home for the holidays. And I got a couple to start us up, to warm us up. Install ad blockers on their web browsers.
Oh, good one, yeah.
You know, because that's always like a way to like screen out a lot of crap that regular users get. Ad blocker.
It's funny, one of my browsers, like I have a work browser and a non-work browser. The work one doesn't have an ad blocker right now, just because like I use internal sites, whatever. Mm-hmm. It is a world of difference.
Yeah, it is. And it takes longer to load, too.
It does take longer. Yeah, absolutely.
So also, check their Wi-Fi security, you know? Make sure WPA is on. Make sure they've got a current patch on.
Odds are they probably have like their address in it or something else stupid.
Yeah, check the, yeah.
I will go a step further and say replace their Wi-Fi or their modem/router combo.
If you can, yeah.
Usually those are terrible.
I agree. In fact,
and usually vulnerable.
This was years ago now, so I've probably talked about it before on the show, but one of the things I did that my family still thanks me for years ago was I bought four of the same Linksys, those wireless G Linksys, and I put a different firmware on there, and I gave them out to the family, set up the Wi-Fi, set it all correctly, and did just that.
Yeah,
replaced the
WRT54G?
Yep, the classic. And, you know, made sure that each one of them had unique passwords, all that stuff. And then the family, there's a family guest network. So when family members come over, they all have they all have a guest network. They automatically join. It works really well. I don't know if they keep them patched, though. So, again, you got to check that.
Well, that's where it helps to have something you're familiar with, too. Like if you get them something totally different and you can't help, especially when they call you over the phone. That's
now,
no good.
Now you can do stuff like the Aero stuff where you can do the mesh coverage to get
Aero,
even better stuff.
You know, I'm 3 months into it now. Aero, E-E-R-O, the Wi-Fi mesh networking solution. If you want to give Wi-Fi to a family member and then never have to bother with their Wi-Fi network again, you can give them Aero. It's expensive, or get them to buy it and give them the gift of setting it up because the setup takes like 5 minutes. They should seriously sponsor the show because I'm 3 months into it. Angela's 3 months into it, literally problem free.
Can't you also manage it remotely?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing you can do. So what do you guys think about like, so I always take the tact of like making sure their PC or Mac's in good shape. Putting like open DNS possibly as their DNS if they got like some crappy DNS.
I know you'll hate this, but I usually use Google DNS.
Or Google. The thing I like about open DNS is then you give them the option of saying screen out ads, screen out porn if they want.
I think IBM just launched a new one. What are they calling it here? Quad 9, which also will start blacklisting dangerous sites as well. So some of the open DNS benefits.
Mm. And that's a DNS service?
Yeah.
Quad 9. Okay, now here's the thing this is where I sort of waffle. Do you go beyond the desktop PC or the laptop, and do you go to the phone now? Because the thing I'm getting a lot at family meetups is my cheap Android phone is out of storage. And the thing I always find is they have a ton of background stuff that's running on there. They usually have like 16 gigs of storage. They're generally they're out of date. They tend to have a lot of updates that need to be installed even just from the Play Store. Like it's just a mess. And then they often don't have passcodes. So this is what I'm telling family is this is I'm going to get a little shit for this, but this is what I'm going to be telling family for their phones this year. Install all your updates, turn on a passcode, and install Google Photos and get all your photos off your phone and put them on Google Photos.
Because that's actually pretty practical.
It's, you know, if you do like the compressed version, it's like free, I think.
Yep.
And the thing is my family members are, what they're doing is they're taking pictures, they're filling up their phone with apps and pictures, and then the phones are just running like crap.
Yep. And they don't, like, most of them probably don't have the skills to transfer them, even when it's easy on Windows and you get, like, it just mounts, but still, that's a big deal.
I say this with some hesitation because I myself have recently converted off of Google Photos, and I'm very creeped out these days, even more than ever, by Google. See this week's Linux Unplugged. So I'm going to, for the family members that I feel like will listen, I'm going to give them, like, you have other options for photo backup speech. But if you just need to, like, it's like my aunt comes from Idaho. I see her literally once a year, and she always brings me her phone now. And it's like I have 15 minutes with her to fix this problem. Like, I can't give her the, you could go install NextCloud on a DigitalOcean droplet speech.
Yeah, right.
You know, I got to solve the problem right there.
Well, I mean, you could do a DigitalOcean one-click install.
Yeah, if I, you know, actually, if I had more time, well, how awesome would it be to get, like, the whole family on one NextCloud instance?
That would be nice.
That would be amazing.
Does OwnCloud / NextCloud have a mobile photo?
Oh, yeah.
Option?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if I had the time and the will to, but the thing is then you're sucked into, once the family depends on this thing, because the dream is big. You know, you protect your family's data, you back up their devices, and maybe even get them off social media for sharing pictures and notes and stuff, because everybody would just be on Nextcloud. You could have a central address book, a central family calendar. I mean, this is the dream.
Sounds
but,
like.
But then you're running a server for your family.
Sounds like there's a now, space for a hosted solution.
That's
that
what I was
going to
say.
Could,
either yeah, a small business oh, yeah. or, yeah. You know, maybe it's like a co-op style thing where you get yep. your family all to pitch money. And
that
then...
is a business. It is a business. And it would be something to seriously think about if you have the will. My problem is that some of my family comes in from out of town and I can't really get my hands on all their systems. So I would also have to come up with ways to get them set up on their desktops. And it just would be a.
That's a that's dangerous.
But so I feel like we're missing a couple of things. Like, what do you think? Is it too far to try to get them to say, like, turn on two-factor for, like, Facebook or Google? Is that too much?
It might be at least, even if you didn't try to make them, like, at least have the discussion about what it is and why they might be interested.
Or if they're, like, an iPhone user, you know, you can set up two-factor now with iCloud.
Right.
So it seems like that might be the way to go because... That's often the two factors, like the line between getting your account screwed over and not.
Yeah, what about like password management too? Is there a conversation
oh,
in here?
Yeah, yeah. I might get some crap for this, but I pretty much universally recommend everybody use LastPass.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of different recommendations these
days. OnePassword's pretty popular.
Yeah, but
for the less technically inclined people, LastPass is just so easy.
Yeah.
And they've also got the whole the auditing thing where they can auto update your passwords,
yeah,
and secure passwords.
Yeah, I think probably password manager and maybe turning on two-factor at least for that, because it's pretty easy with Google Authenticator or Authy or even text messages. There's a lot of really user-friendly ways to do two-factor now. It's not as hard as it used to be.
It's as long as you can, you know, you use one of the services where there's a way to make sure they understand like what happens if they break their phone, because otherwise. If you haven't talked about it, you're probably going to get a call when they lose their phone and they can't get into their email anymore.
Speaking of Brian Krebs earlier, he has three rules for family members. And these maybe we wrap with these three rules unless you guys have any other implicit things you want to call out. But maybe these are the final three rules. If you have a family member who will listen, because you're not going to get very far if they're not receiving this. But if they're listening, three rules. If you didn't go looking for it, don't install it. Number two, if you installed it, update it. And number three, if you no longer need it, remove it. Since we're all here, we're going to bang out a few tech stories on the Use Air program. Do a little tech news. Wham, wham, wham. This is a follow-up story to something we talked about before on the show. It looks like rogue couriers can enter your home by disabling the Amazon Key Smart Lock. Remember when we talked about this on the show, the Key Smart Lock? Yep. It's only been a few weeks since Amazon introduced this, and it turns out there was a way to get around this and unlock the door.
Amazon, like, hire us.
Right out of the gate? Like, right out of the gate this happens?
I mean, I guess that's the best time for it to be found out, but yeah. Wow.
Yeah, Amazon's got it patched by now. Now that we're recording this, and this, by the time this is coming out, it's all been patched. Not a great way to start the product, and it's really not been received well. And surveys show that consumers are not interested in this either. Not too unexpected. I still think it has a place in the market for people that it might be getting pharmacy prescription deliveries in the future.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could see that being a market for this. People that maybe have accessibility issues with getting to the door and opening it for UPS, this could be something they would use. But
or maybe houses that have like the double door entryways.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Sure. So, all right. So, yeah, this isn't really a major security issue, but it sounds like you had one you wanted to bring to the class. Share with us, Wes.
Yeah, well, it sounds like Uber had a pretty massive data breach back in 2016. Instead of telling anyone about it, they paid the hackers a bunch of money to delete the data and keep it quiet.
Supposedly delete the data. I mean, how do you really
know? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think you can.
Yeah, so they paid the hackers $100,000 to delete the info and keep quiet. Here's a little hush money.
Now, did they pay them in cash or Bitcoin?
That's a good question, because, boy, Bitcoin, now they're looking great.
Yeah, no kidding, right? I guess so. Let's see. The compromised data from October 2016 attack included names, email addresses, and phone numbers of 50 million Uber riders around the world. This is according to a report on Bloomberg.
A whole bunch of driver's license numbers.
Yeah, 7 million drivers were accessed as well, including 600,000 U.S. driver licenses numbers. You combine this with DJI just had a massive breach. Did you hear about this?
Yeah.
And they went after the guy. Even though he was following the rules of their bug bounty program, they went after the guy. Well, at least this is his side of the story. And he found an S3 bucket that was just wide open with users' personal information, their ID, stuff that you have to submit to DJI to be cleared to fly in certain areas, stuff that I've had to submit. Just sitting up on an S3 bucket, like labeled dev something. And then when they told them about it, they tried to go after him under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
You just see that kind of behavior. It really, really makes you sick, especially when like people, even especially in this case where it's not even like you entered a compromised system in an act of good faith, you know, not having bad intentions, but just issuing HTTP GET requests and then getting gone after when you're trying to do responsible disclosure. Insane. Well,
not only that, but it also depresses people wanting to report that stuff in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you just want to just go directly to the black market. I feel like this, ironically, is also a TechSnap topic. You know, this something that is, the bug bounty programs have been something that really kind of got a start while TechSnap was going. And you see all these companies now that are launching them, but some of them are not really great citizens of the program.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting to see something major happen with Apple. They have like their own bug bounty program.
Right. Theirs is a little different. Some companies do it really well, and that's great to see. And others, yeah, you're like, well, are you just doing this because you're trying to play along, or do you actually care? Do you actually expect to get good results out of the program?
So here's where we're at. You've got DJI, who has S3 buckets open to the world with driver's license and all kinds of identifying information. You've got Uber, who's leaking this stuff. Equifax. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on and on. We got to change the way we talk about this, because it seems like almost anybody's identity is probably available for the plucking if they mattered enough for somebody to choose them, or if they just ended up in some sort of random grab bag of identities that get sold. Like, we need to start talking about this like we're fucked. And now what are you going to do? Are you going? Do you lock your credit down? Do you change the way you browse the web? Do you start ensuring that your communications are cryptographically signed as you, so that way, if ever in the future somebody were to try to take over your identity, they wouldn't have it. And of course, you've got to start now, because if you never know when that could happen. Like, how do we need to change the conversation to go from do these things to protect your identity to assume you've been compromised? Because it really feels like, even if that's not the case, that's the best operating assumption to be under to prevent something bad like identity theft from happening, which can really wreck your shit. I just was talking to somebody who is like 3 years into digging out of an identity theft.
Ugh.
They really got screwed over, and they still are. They're still battling with it, because so much here in the States is linked to your credit and what the credit agencies say about you and your social security number, even though it shouldn't be. It's all so intrinsically linked together with who you are and how much trust that the system wants to put in you as a consumer, that when somebody comes along and they meddle with that and they open up 39 store accounts in this person's
case,
39 different store cards, and then just trash your credit It can take you years to dig out of it. So I feel like that's a conversation we here at JB could do better at having. I just don't know how to have it. I don't know. Like, I feel like we need to have a lot of people give us input on this and come to some sort of common consensus on how people should protect themselves.
I've also seen some people who, you know, they've gotten to the point where they don't want to deal with it at all. You know, like, I'm not even going to go online bank. I'll just go to the darn branch. And I don't know if that's the right answer.
I feel like if we could come up with like a do these five things, even though it's not everything, but just do these five things and you're going to be significantly better off. You're statistically going to be 70% better off or something. I feel like that would be really beneficial to the audience, but I don't know what those things would be.
I feel like the problem is it's there's not five things you can do, because
it's changing too, and specific.
Not only that, but it's not necessarily things that you're doing wrong in the first place. It's these services that you're using that are doing things wrong.
And you don't even know what kind of information they have.
And I feel like that the only way to work around things like that are things that do exist, like things like Apple Pay. You are only trusting your information to one company, and if they do well, then you're good. But you can use that with other companies, and they don't have to have that information in the first place to leak.
Yeah, there's. If I was on a cryptocurrency podcast, I could go on quite a bit of a bender right here about how cryptocurrency and smart contracts and a lot of those could solve this problem where you can have implicit trust and a way to measure someone's reliability without having to know everything about them. There is, because it's math. Maybe we'll do a future episode on that. But before we go too far, I thought maybe we should shift over. And do you have any other stories we want to do before we shift? Because I thought maybe we could talk a little TechSnap.
Oh.
Talk a little TechSnap. All right. Well, let's take a break, and then we'll talk TechSnap. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. Go there to support the show. Sign up for a free 7-day trial. Not a trail, but a trial to a platform that is built to teach you everything you need to know about Linux. Everything around Linux to advance your career, too. Like the big topic stuff. The one I always go to for that is, like an example, is OpenStack. That thing's a mind bender. And they have some of the best courseware in the industry. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. Self-paced, in-depth video courses on every Linux, cloud, and DevOps topic. Hands-on, real scenario-based labs. If you're like me and you don't test well, that's the kind of stuff that puts it over the top for you. And they have human beings, real instructors available to help whenever you need. Wise folk there to help you learn. Study tools you can download and take with you offline, iOS and Android apps for on the go. It's a great platform and it's stacked full of Jupyter Broadcasting community members. They're adding new stuff all the time. They're amending the old stuff, and they're always advancing the platform. It continues to get more and more valuable as you go. And one of the features they introduced now earlier this year, it's been a little bit, but I think is just a perfect example of this, is the public profiles. It's a great way to illustrate the work you've done. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. Go there and see what I'm talking about. Log into the dashboard and get a sense of what you can get done. With the free 7-day trial, why not? LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged.
So, I've got two people here, and they've been concocting something in my home, and I don't even know about it, and I need it explained. What's going on with TechSnap?
To be fair, the really juicy stuff we planned out at over meals.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So, to avoid.
Big juicy pieces of meat.
So you leave the place to make sure I don't know?
Well, we didn't want you to get too suspicious,
Beard. We never know if there's microphones hidden in my beard, you know?
Guys, you do realize I edit this show.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that.
Right, of course. Yeah, so I don't know. It was a little bit ago, Dan came to me and he said, I think I'm going to step back from the show because I have these projects I'm working on. Like, he organizes a lot of BSD community events and other events. He has also got full-time employment at Cisco and he's just got a lot going on.
Plus, he needs some time to eat his figs.
That's true. That's an important part of the lifestyle.
Well, there is something to that. You know, you do have to take time for yourself from time to time, too. And so he said, you know, I think I should probably step back from the show because I'm not going to be able to give it the full time that I think it deserves. And, you know, I think maybe I would be speculating, but people were probably, you know, when you get comments like, it seems like Dan's just reading the webpage, that probably, you know, those things probably kind of were registering as like, well, maybe I'm not giving this enough prep time. I don't know what his thought process was, but I respected his decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I really respected the fact that he just came to me and said, you know, I think I'm overdoing it. And I want to just focus on these projects because, geez, that's the kind of self-honesty I could have used a few years ago before I went too far. I
feel like burnt out doing like a bajillion shows at once.
I feel like I'm getting there now, right? But it took years of doing it the wrong way. So I totally respect where he's coming from. And plus, also, the TechSnap format was sort of concocted in a different era of podcasting.
It's funny how much has changed.
Yeah, it's the same thing with LAS, and that is, it wasn't really sure what it was when it started, and it sort of organically grew into something, and there was certain things that were done that were never really discussed. It was just sort of, we're doing it because we can or we feel like it, and if you were going to reboot a show and start over again, you look at some of those things and you go, I don't think we would do it that way. And so I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about, because we got a lot of changes in mind. All I hope for the better, and we're going to be really try to be responsive to audience feedback. But initially, you know, the first thing I question these days is the segment format, where you have the main segment, and then you have a feedback segment.
Right.
And then you have a roundup, and there's musical bumps in between each one. that feels like a bygone era of podcasting that you don't really do anymore.
Like, right, it's kind of inspired from like 2000s era news programs or something like that.
Or cable television.
Yeah, cable television.
You know, like ZDNet TV or whatever. And it's just not really, it doesn't really, like when you're listening and you know, the first couple times you listen to a show, you're like, oh, that's great. Yeah, like, look at that. They got some funny roundup music. But like the 200th time, or in some case, the 346th time that you've listened to a show, you're like, okay, I got it. Yeah, I don't need to hear the intro music every single time. I don't need to hear that long, crazy roundup music.
It also kind of pulls you away from it, right? Like, it feels less like one of podcasting's great things is you kind of get, it's more freeform, you're interacting, and you feel almost like you're there with the people. Not so much when it's overproduced.
It feels like artificial constraints. Like, we got to go to a segment break. We'll be right back.
Well, on the flip side, it does give you good like break points to stop and go do something else and then come back to do it later.
True. Yeah, it does. Yeah, but you can accomplish that with decent editing. You know, you know we could stop this show for a couple of minutes, go take a pee, and come back and kind of edit that part out. Like, if you do it right.
Well, I was thinking more from the listener side, though.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like, pause the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. There's all kinds of things I'm considering, though. I don't really know if I have the tools to pull it off, but like one thing I'm thinking about would be really great with TechSnap would be, I shouldn't say this because I'm almost positive we can't do it under Linux, but I'm hoping there might be a way, so that's why I'm saying it out loud, is chapter markers. A lot of podcast players, especially on mobile devices now, support chapter markers. So we would take like some of the time coding we do for user error, but something a little less intensive, but would actually be embedded in the ID3 information of the
MP3 file. That would be nice.
And then like a lot like Pocket Cast and Pod Addict and a lot of other podcast Overcast and other podcast players will read that, and you can actually tap right to the time.
So if there's like a story you really want to hear about, just jump to it.
It's something, if I don't know if we'll be able to do initially, but it's something I'd like to kind of get to.
I like that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I think we should probably talk about is, because it's the biggest format change, is you and I are toying around with the idea of sort of flipping the script a little bit. And Wes would take on more of kind of the Alan Jude Dan role. And I would sort of take back my old role of sort of moving it along and setting it up. And then instead of like the more like just read a story, we would, and I have a whole bunch of them in a show and have like a roundup and have a whole bunch of news stories, we would probably stick to like three, maybe four stories depending on the week, but just go really deep on each one. Like, tell you the stuff that like other podcasts or other news sites aren't writing about, or the stuff that we specifically think is interesting and worth discussing, and sort of really try to draw out a lot of the good nuance out of some of these interesting stories. Like this DJI story I just covered I talked about it in the show. There's a, you know, this DJI story about this, all of our information being out on these S3 buckets, there's tons of stuff to dig into that story. Like how he discovered it, all of that. We could really do a deep dive on those kinds of stories.
And there's a lot of times like where something topical in the news comes up, but it's like, well, maybe we've never really talked about like, what is this S3 stuff? How does it all work? What are the security concerns you need to know if you're using it? And it's like a natural bridge to a lot of discussing more in-depth topics than you get if you're just like, hey, this thing happened.
Now, there's also like a harsh reality to this transition. It means I'm doing another show, and it's kind of coming at a good time because I've been getting more involved in some systems side stuff here at JB again. I've been setting up some new servers, been standardizing some of the workstations, and been messing around with Landscape to sort of centralize the management, and I'm going to be moving to something else. And all of that, I can document all of that on the show, like setting up some sort of central configuration management and standardized system deployment scheme here with the studio.
You're making me excited already.
Yeah, all that, we can talk about that in the show. But it does mean I'm doing another show. And I kind of stopped doing TechSnap to sort of free myself up. And I think we're going to make some changes, perhaps make it slightly shorter. And like I said, refocus on certain news stories and other changes.
And like,
will make
to
it
be
sustainable.
Clear. Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say, is that like, we want to produce a quality show that has interesting, novel ideas and analysis and insights, and we have to figure out a way where like you can do that, where I can do that, where we have enough time and we can produce something that's really of value.
Right. And something that works with sort of our flexible schedules.
Because
sometimes your work demands certain things, sometimes JB demands certain things, sometimes I'm traveling. So we need something that can work with that. And then one thing I haven't talked to you about, but maybe we just talk about this part on the show, is I don't really know. This is just an out there idea, but if it was good, done right, I don't think we've never maybe once did an interview on TechSnap ever.
Right. Yeah.
And if we could record the show in a way where we could take like the best bits of an interview and have like a 5-10 minute discussion in the show with another, you know, another like-minded expert or a system administrator who's out in the trenches somewhere.
Krebs.
Yeah, or a guest like Brian Krebs kind of thing. Or there's a lot of events, and you and I were just discussing what was the Seattle event we were just discussing, like the system administrators meetup event?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we could take a couple of recorders down there, and if we got a couple of interesting stories from some folks.
That'd be perfect.
Yeah. So there's some things we want to work with that the show's never done before, but we're not necessarily dead set on anything. And there may be some changes in like the production format and how we do the video, if we do video, and where the RSS feeds come from eventually. We may rework the back end of TechSnap, because not only is it the show that's sort of a format that is not really modern anymore. Still love it, but it's not super modern. It was also, what do you call it? It was set up, constructed, published in a different era. Like the back end infrastructure for TechSnap is nothing like User Error or Linux Action News or Ask Noah.
Yeah,
it's totally different.
Right. The new breed of JB shows do things in a more efficient, streamlined way,
right,
and just makes more sense.
Yeah, and so it would probably make sense too to move TechSnap over to that new system if we're going to be making
this is like
change.
A proper reboot.
Yeah. And we're going to be doing it fast. Next week, 347 is Dan's last episode.
Yep.
And then the week after that, in December, you and I take over.
A bold new era.
Woo. I know, that's a lot. That's a lot of changes to make, especially if we're going to redo the whole backend infrastructure. So expect it to change over time, too. Like, we may start with a bit minimum viable product, try to make it as far as we can, and then just keep adding based on or tweaking based on what we get in audience feedback.
That's a huge aspect of it, I think, because like TechSnap in particular, especially due to just how long it's been going, the amount of people have really loved that program. So it's a great time to, you know, reflect on what you like, what you don't like, what you think should be changed about, or what you really wish that it did talk about. If it doesn't, let us know.
Yeah. And I got a couple of project ideas here in the studio that are related to like migrating our free NAS and resetting up a new ZFS storage array.
Oh.
And you know, it would be really cool if when we're out in the garage working on that, just bring the portable Zoom recorder. If there was a couple of really great moments of like during that migration that we could capture and then sort of cut up and put into like, here's what we went through, and actually be able to play the moment for you. There's all kinds of stuff I think I want to play with, but I still want to keep it genuine to really good, deep analysis on stories that you're going to go, huh, I'm glad I know that now. That's really what we're going to go for with TechSnap. It's the Systems Network and Administration podcast. And it's like a powerhouse. Like we, you know, we're like, we always think about the whole range, everything from let's just end the show.
Yeah.
Let's just
absolutely.
Have Dan and Wes wrap it. And that we'll call that the end to let's completely reformat it. And so we try to think about the whole spectrum, took a couple of months to think about it. And I think this is going to be a pretty good approach because we're going to build something that could probably go for another 350 episodes, even if it's not you and I. If it eventually we hand it off to somebody else, like
right, absolutely.
it'll be in a really great sustainable position. And we'll have rethought about what this show is, what does it mean, what is its focus, what is its purpose, where does it fit on the network with
That's
all the other shows.
That's a big part too, right? Like the whole subset of shows that exist around it has totally changed too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think it's going to be a necessary reboot when you think about it. It wasn't something we were really necessarily geared up to do.
No, it wasn't exactly the right time or the best time for something like this to happen. But.
Right. But, you know, in retrospect, it feels like it's probably the right time to do it, actually. It's probably the necessary time to do it. Just looking at stats and things like that, I think it's also the necessary time. So check out 346 for Dan's goodbye, 347 for his final episode, and then 348 for the first episode of Wes and I of TechSnap.
To be determined.
Woo.
TechSnap distilled.
Business?
Whether you're a business... That was good, right?
Wow.
I was onto it there for a second. I thought that was...
Is that a Mr. Dominic sample. That's amazing.
We just keep going. This is the ad right here. We're gonna still
really?
Do it.
You want it?
Let's
you
keep doing.
Really?
Let's keep going.
But I just knocked over a
pen. Doesn't matter.
It's over. There's a pen that I got.
Doesn't matter.
That's how powerful DigitalOcean is.
The pen was surprised at the deal. Because
I felt like I could do a better job in DigitalOcean. It's so great. It deserves more. You know, like it deserved like maybe like a business and a
get out of here
combo. Like that would have been a better intro.
Why would I get out of here? I got to stay here. I got to sign up for DigitalOcean.
No, you got to get out of here and go over to DigitalOcean.com, sign up, and use our promo code. Here's the thing.
This
all
is the
one
future,
word.
Chris, I can stay here and sign up
you
on my
can?
Phone, probably.
What? You can, actually. You say probably, but you can. In fact, they also have a bunch of great apps that are built around their simple, intuitive API. They have SSDs for every kind of rig you'd spin up, block and object storage. Boom, I just threw that at you. I just threw that at you, but let it sink in. They got block storage. You attach that to your Linux rig, and it shows up as a block device, like a dev SDA kind of device. Or they got the object storage. This is beautiful, simple object storage. It's scalable. It's programmaticable. That's a word, right?
Programmaticable.
Yeah, programmaticable. Yeah.
You'll go with you'll right.
Highly programmaticable.
It is. It is highly programmaticable.
I have lots of programmaticability experience,
and you can try it right now by going to DigitalOcean.com using our promo code. Here's the thing, all one word. And then when you're ready to throw these systems in production, they got load balancing as a service, monitoring and alerting, lightning fast networking, team account support, and pricing that's going to blow you away.
So do I understand that storage correctly? You can connect it to a droplet and then put stuff on it and disconnect it and connect it to another droplet?
That is, it's definitely with the object storage. And I think with the block storage, you could probably get away with that depending on how you moved it. So you'd hide definitely with the object storage, yeah. Because with the object storage, you can actually generate URLs for each individual file if you want. It's so cool. Speaking of cool, their documentation, top-notch cool, ultimate cool. It's so cool, it's ice cold. And they have a great guide on creating a point-to-point VPN with WireGuard on Ubuntu 16.04.
What? I didn't know that, and yep. I love WireGuard.
That's why I brought it up for you, buddy.
Chris.
I was reading it last night, and I was like, I gotta tell Wes about this. It's good, too. I'm thinking about playing around with WireGuard, do it between maybe like a droplet and my own private network, or, you know, there's all kinds of things I could use WireGuard for with DigitalOcean. Check them out at DigitalOcean.com, create your account, and either if you are a
business
or just somebody who's an enthusiast, you'll find something you can do at DigitalOcean.
You know what I want to see? I want to see somebody create an app that uses that object storage where you can just drop a file into the app and it uses the DigitalOcean API to stick it on there and just give you a URL in your clipboard that you can just share with someone.
That would actually be a great Linux desktop app, like something that just runs in the corner. You drop an app on there, it uses this.
Yeah. Who needs FTP? Who needs Dropbox?
No, exactly.
I just need instant sharing.
We do. We just want to transfer large files for like a couple of hours.
Yep.
And we end up using these services like Google Drive or Dropbox or Nextcloud that are synchronizing, and they're not really the right tool for the job. It would be easy to build something around that. It's pretty nice. And the documentation's tops.
So DigitalOcean exposes everything on the API.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what you're going to pay. Like, I use S3 for a number of things, but it's like, well, I don't really know. With DigitalOcean, it's like upfront. It's clear, easy to understand, makes it really easy to use in your business.
I'm going
to
ding that. That is so true. That's one of the things we like about it a lot. DigitalOcean.com, promo code, here's the thing. Gentlemen, let's do a round of hashtag Ask Air, and the holidays have me thinking of a classic song that, listening back to it now, is horribly and completely inappropriate. And I give you right here exhibit A of a classic song we've heard millions of times that really sounds actually like it's about an old man that's trying to put the moves on a young girl.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my mother will start to
beautiful
worry.
What's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
well,
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink
put
more.
Some records on while I
the neighbor.
And then they sing about how there's something in this drink. I think I'm under some spell or something like that. Like he slips something in her drink and takes advantage of her in the song.
That's not okay.
No, that seems like the kind of song that would never get made today. So that's a completely... But yet I can't help but love that clip. You know, one of in that song's defense, there are several songs where they flip the roles.
Right.
And that, you know, okay, that makes it a little more modern, I suppose. But what do you got? You got any songs that you remember that looking back at it are completely inappropriate? Can you beat that one?
I don't think I can.
No. I came in with a winner, didn't I?
You sure did.
Boom. All right. Moving on to the next question then. No reason to daughter. Hashtag Ask Air. What is unethical as F, but completely a common practice in the business world? Something that businesses get away with all the time, but if you were a regular old Joe Schmo, you could never do it.
Tax evasion?
Jeez, yeah, a lot of that stuff. You know, one is, you know, like one of the things that really creeps me out about Apple and Google, but Apple, you hear stories about it, is they have like a police force. They have like a team that they have sent out when somebody has like a stolen iPhone from a bar. Remember that Gizmodo guy?
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
They have security personnel that works with law enforcement. So they call up the local PO and they say, hey, we're going to this guy's house. We'd like you to come with us.
So there's obviously a lot of trust and established relationships
up, knocking on the door, and it's three or four security people from Apple, and they got you know, burly-looking people, they got mace, they got Apple logo shirts on, and they will hustle you. They've hustled people, and they have like a strike force.
I mean, you can do that as an individual, though. You can get a personal bodyguard.
Maybe, yeah. Of course, you got to be of a certain stature.
Right. But, like, I was just thinking about, like, Bezos, right? Like, and... If he was
own bodyguard.
Yeah, right. But I mean, he's got a whole company. If you're trapped somewhere in one of those giant Amazon complexes, like that's their world.
Yeah. My experience, I was working at a bank when they made the business decision to allow people to overdraw and then charge them. See, traditionally, this was a small bank and you couldn't overdraw. You would just get declined. And they started watching the bigger banks, the big multinational banks, start charging overdraft fees, and it became a huge revenue source for them. It's extremely profitable to let people overdraft and then charge them $25 for a dollar thing of gum. And so I watched a bank go through the process of debating it, determining what the fee would be, discussing the rationale, and then implementing it. And they went from a mode of, no, we're just not going to let you spend money you don't have to. Yeah, go ahead. Spend that money. And then I watched them turn up the fee from $5 to $15 to $25 by the time I left.
I mean, isn't that the basis of America, though? Nice, live off credit?
Oh, man, I guess.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, I suppose so. Okay, so those are the two I brought for the classes. Anybody else have an Ask Air today? Did you see any in the Discord?
There was Derek who said that our discussion of In the Plex made him run out and buy the book and read it.
Oh, yeah?
It was really good. He was really creeped out.
Yeah.
But ultimately fascinated. And yeah. He wants to know if we have any other good books.
Into the Plex. So if you guys didn't hear the recommendation, Into the Plex is a book that goes into the origins of Google and really into the sort of the way the Google in sort of corporation works and some of the interesting struggles that they had about things that are creepy. And yeah. So if you're looking for some other books, just current books that I really, really like, two books that I cannot recommend enough and strongly recommend you get them in any format you can is number one is Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. It's 15 hours on Audible. And that's so Sapiens. And then the other one that I've been recommending a lot recently is Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging. I've mentioned that on the show before.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in New York, Tribe. There's Tribes with an S, and this is Tribe. And that is going to, if you're a Linux user and you've been involved in or any kind of online community, you're a gamer, Tribe is going to, so much is going to make sense to you. Why there's arguments and comment threads, why people have geek throwdowns, why we all look at what different people's desktop choices are and make thoughts and decisions about them, why we get upset when somebody on YouTube says something you disagree with. It's a great read, Tribe. Just Tribe, colon, on the home, I'm sorry, Tribe, colon, on Homecoming and Belonging, which doesn't sound like it would be like that kind of book. So that's why I want to just give it a strong recommendation because, boy, I was impressed. I'll just play a little sample.
Introduction. In the fall of 1986, just out of college, I set out to hitchhike across the northwestern part of the United States. I'd hardly ever been west of the Hudson River, and in my mind, what waited for me out in Dakota and Wyoming and Montana was not only the real America, but the real me as well. I'd grown up in a Boston suburb where people's homes were set behind deep hedges or protected by huge yards, and neighbors hardly knew each other. And they didn't need to. Nothing ever happened in my town that required anything close to a collective effort. Anything bad that happened was taken care of by the police or the fire department, or at the very least, the town maintenance crews. I worked for them one summer. I remember shoveling a little too hard.
You may have heard this before. I've played the preview before. Such a good book. Such a good book. And it's also one of those books that if you get the Kindle version, it'll sync to it. So you can read part of it.
Fancy.
Which is one of my favorite ways. So yeah, there's a couple. There's a couple of recommendations. You guys have any other books you want to throw in the mix?
Are we keeping this to like nonfiction stuff?
No, I think we could do fiction. I mean, I thought that was kind of the thrust of it, but I think we could do.
I haven't been reading anything that's nonfiction lately, but I've been rereading the Ender's Game series.
Oh, that's good.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah,
and one of my favorite book series of all time is the His Dark Materials trilogy, like Golden Compass,
Philip Pullman's work.
Yep.
If you want a comedy book that is great to listen to with a significant other, it's much better if your parents, because a lot of it's dad jokes. It's Dad is Fat. Dad is Fat by Jeff Gaffigan, I guess, whatever his name is.
Jeff Gaffigan?
Yeah, a lot of good laughs in that. I was surprised. We used that book to we thought, well, we'll just listen to this while we go to sleep, because we have a few books that we just listen to fall asleep. Got a lot of good laughs out of that book, a surprising amount. So, yeah, check that one out, too. Dad is Fat was also pretty good.
I've been reading Salt by Mark Krelansky, which is a history of the world through the lens of salt, and he's just got out a new one called Paper, which is the same idea but about the history of paper. And it's a good mix where you get some really good in-depth history that kind of joins disparate parts of the world through one lens, but it doesn't go too far where you get bored. So right in the spot where you're like, well, I've heard a lot about this town in Italy in the 1600s, you jump and now you're in Norway or somewhere else. But it's still on a common thread.
I like that.
The other, I'll give a nonfiction or a fiction too. I really enjoy Ian Banks' Culture series, which is a sci-fi series set in the future. There's AI, and it's really a post-scarcity society like the Federation, you could say, but on a much grander scale. And they use that to tell really interesting, meaningful stories about like how interacting with other cultures might work and what it means to exist as a sentient being when you're not constrained.
Ooh, we kind of talked about that before the show. The other book that I bought a couple of years ago that still stands out because it just kind of gave insight into Silicon Valley is The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. It's a long one, though. It's 17 hours if you get the audiobook version of it. Yeah, that's a pretty good list.
Well, these are good things to listen to while you're traveling for the holidays, though.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't plan to talk about this, so I don't necessarily have links for all the show notes for all this stuff. So I apologize about that, but hopefully we said the names enough that if we were going to talk about it, I would have put links in there. But that was just going from memory. So, yeah, okay. Good ask here. Should we cap it right there? Well, one more?
He also asks if we have any thoughts on the movie Revolution OS.
Oh, I haven't watched that in forever.
Yeah, it's been ages.
I was recently thinking about.
I don't even remember what it's about.
Oh, it's about the GNU revolution. Let's go get the trailer, because here's the other thing is, do you remember it's kind of in the same vein, although Revolution OS is less dramatic as Pirates of Silicon Valley. Do you remember Pirates of Silicon Valley?
That's the one about Apple and Microsoft, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Revolution OS, the full movie though, is up on YouTube. It's like an hour and 25 minutes. So you can, I'll just play. It came out like, I don't know, five, six years ago. And it's, it's about our thing. It's about our jam.
These are the freedoms that enable people to form a community. If you don't have all these freedoms, you're being divided and dominated by somebody.
I'm your worst nightmare.
Yeah, this is some music, dude.
Explain what Linux is, you have to explain what an operating system is.
So yeah, you kind of get an idea. It's a great movie if you haven't seen it and you're into Linux. You want to see clips of RMS and Linus from ages ago. Like here's an old clip of RMS, kind of a classic.
Price, but to freedom. So think of free speech, not free beer.
That's where, that gets quoted a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. If people like that, Linus has a sort of biography just for fun. I read about half of it. I haven't quite finished. It's on my shelf of to-dos, but I enjoyed that a lot and just gives you a perspective into like what was going through Linus's head when he created all this, a little bit about his childhood, his history, his interactions with computers over the years, and gets a lot of good perspective.
There you go. Well, there is a batch of user error book and now movie recommendations. We find ourselves in a situation where both of you may need to build like a mini studio for the beard in a new place, and for Wes, where he's lived for a bit now. And I thought it'd be a good topic for the show. We talk about it right here on the show.
Yeah.
I think I'm a bit ahead of Wes. I already have a nice mixer, Chris.
Yeah, I guess we start with the hardware.
Yeah, so that's pretty important.
This is applicable to anybody that's looking at starting a podcast. There's like two routes in front of you. And the first route is the easy route, and you just get a microphone that plugs into a USB port, and it's really simple. And if you're lucky, it's a microphone that has a headphone jack so you can hear yourself, so you can monitor how you're using the microphone.
If you want to sustain a podcast, that's not the route to choose.
It's really limited. You're going to end up trying to do tons of software hacks and processing to try to make your audio sound good, which always end up being unreliable. And it's not that they're super unstable. It's that when you're recording, they need to be 100% reliable, because there is nothing more demotivating and devastating than losing an entire show, especially one that you think is really good. We have lost a couple of gems here at JB that we were really proud of, and it was devastating to lose those shows.
If people want to know a secret, we almost lost the last episode of User, but because we're using more advanced stuff, we were able to recover.
Yeah, we had a backup route. But fundamentally, you're really going to be limited in that setup, because you won't be able to really do guest audio very well. You won't be able to, say, like, have a soundboard, or maybe you want audio from your computer to get audio from a video or something. Like, you won't ever be able to do any of that.
You won't be able to isolate different audio tracks.
Yeah. And so you end up getting into the range of a mixer. And you have different, you can have mixers that are under $100 to ones that are tens of thousands, and maybe, way beyond anything I could ever even dream of. And so you got to find the right one that's in a sweet spot. I like one for a home setup that connects in over USB. So the audio is actually coming, the mixer shows up as a USB audio device.
Oh, that does sound pretty handy.
Yeah. And depending on the OS support and the mixer, each input on the mixer might also show up as an input into the machine, which could be great for multi-track recording and things like that. And generally, if you have a USB mixer, it almost always just works with Linux, because they're just using standard components.
Right.
And that's a pretty nice way to go, but there's a lot of range and quality with mixers, as Beard has discovered.
Yeah. I can personally recommend against Behringer. Yeah,
especially at the smaller range.
Yeah, on the low end, like anything below like $500.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Because their quality control on the low end is not very great.
Yeah. There's a few models that are pretty good, but
they'd gotten better of late, but I don't know if that's true.
I literally returned, this was like within the past couple of years, I literally returned three Behringer mixers.
Wow.
And I ended up just returning it completely and getting a Mackie mixer, which I've had no problems with.
Yeah, I think for the smaller end setups, the Mackie, there's a tiny bit of a price premium there, but they have some of the best sounding preamps too.
Yeah, it's like $50 or $100.
I say that, I'm literally leaning on our Behringer mixer right now here in the studio. So we use a Behringer here in the studio, but this is a higher end product. This is way, way, way beyond anything you'd do at home. So if you got something like that, it's pretty great. What I actually end up using is a device pretty similar to what I've described, and I almost always just keep a little physical hardware recorder next to it too, that I just record a backup audio to. So I don't have to have some sophisticated, I have this little thing, a Zoom recorder that I can plug in when I'm on the road, and I use that to do a local backup recording as well. Because if you're working in a remote studio, you're going to want to record just your end of the audio, not both ends of the conversation.
That's an important distinction.
The other person's recording their end of the conversation. And this is another place where a mixer makes this a lot easier to do. So you're going to want to be able to record just your audio, but you're still going to be able to hear them. So you have to set up your audio in a way where you can monitor both ends of the conversation, but only record your end.
So this is where you need like a little flexibility, being able to reroute things.
Yeah, and there's some software to let you do this. So that's sort of the physical setup. Then you got that's the audio routing setup. But then of course there's a lot of other components like mic, and
you can also use those Zoom recorder things to interface with your mixer sometimes to have backups directly from the mixer.
Mm-hmm. And the Zoom
just
recorder
straight hardware.
Yeah, and the Zoom recorder can also show up as a USB sound device, which is pretty nice in a pinch. Really little handy utility. So you got to pick a microphone. And if you can, it's nice to match the microphone that your co-host is using. It's hard because people like to change up their microphones to try to get the right sound.
Right.
Yeah, I would say if you want quality, though, the microphone is the number one thing you want to spend money on.
Yeah. And you have different kinds of mics. You have dynamic mics, which like that one there on the floor.
Yeah.
That's a dynamic mic. The reason why it's on the floor is because it's a dynamic mic. And it would pick up, if you brushed your feet on the carpet over there, it would pick it up potentially. It's pretty hot. But it also means you can sit here and you can talk without having to shout, and it really gets the fullness of your voice. But you got to have a really quiet space for that.
And that means you also have to learn how to be around it. That's a lot of things I see. You know, people they don't know how to interface with the mic. They don't know how to make it sound like they want. And if you don't have that monitor set up really well, then you don't really know what it sounds like till you've already edited and your podcast is terrible.
Yeah. And so, what's the other? There's dynamic mics and then
condenser
mics. Thank you. So these are condenser microphones. And those usually have better off-axis rejection. Don't go by my just these are just highlights to know. Like I guess to make it more practical, I would say if you can afford it, you're gonna have a lot of great results with something that they use in radio, something like an RE320, or there's a lot of different microphones. Everybody, the hard thing about different mics is you kind of need to try different ones and see one works best with your microphone or with your voice. I mean, like condenser mics are generally gonna be best though in louder situations.
Generally, if you're just trying to be super cheap though and just try to bootstrap from the minimal amount of money, I generally see that the AT2020 is recommended.
Yep. And I think that's available in XLR or USB too.
Yep.
Which is pretty nice.
I think it's actually always XLR, but it has a USB adapter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you can start as USB and then switch over to XLR later.
I don't tend to like the blue microphones, like the blue Yetis.
Oh, the Yeti, right.
And the Snowballs. The Yetis are pretty good. If you're going to get a blue microphone, Yetis.
I disagree.
I mean, for Yetis. I mean, as far as Yeti microphones go, as far as blue microphones go, like the Yetis, they're better one.
I guess. And there is a pro version that comes in XLR too.
Yeah. But
at that point, the price is getting so high that you might as well just go buy
an RE320 or a Rode Podcaster would be better too.
Oh yeah.
So I'm kind of ambivalent on the microphone thing because I feel like it's something that everybody goes through. Like when you really get into recording, you just go through a microphone period usually. And so I can tell you, you know, with mic I use right now, this is the RE320. And this is a dynamic, so I think I got I got the mic types backwards. So the dynamic ones have better off-axis rejection, a little quieter.
Wes is on a Heil PR40.
Yeah, that's a Heil PR40 over there.
What about microphone accessories?
So
things like
there.
Stands, pop filters. How needed are those? Fancy mounts?
Pretty varying. You know, you're definitely gonna want a pop filter, mm-hmm. or get a microphone that has one built in.
The only thing I would say that is required is a boom.
You think a boom's required?
Yeah. A boom and usually a shock mount.
Yeah, here's the thing is you do want to get that microphone up off the table if possible, or at least isolated from noise, because every keyboard
keyboard,
it'll all go into the microphone. And if you have a dynamic mic, you know, depending like the PR40, it might be a little bit better for like the typing noise, but the bass of the typing, the thump 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 thud, that will still get in a microphone like that. So that's something to think about is can you get it off the ground or like see how that's in a spider mount?
Yes.
So that's sort of isolated there in that spider mount. So do your research on microphones. Just go, you can find YouTube videos and people will do different voice tests. See what kind of you think works there.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Don't listen to Chris when it comes to microphones because I'm changing my mind all the time. I get the types of microphones confused constantly. Don't listen to Chris. Just try out what works for you. I've landed on the RE320. I used to use the PR40. I don't think it's as good of a microphone. And when I want a really like rich microphone and I'm in a really quiet room, I just use a MXL390. It's like a $70 microphone. It's not super.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So
and we're not even at the top of the microphone spectrum ourselves. Yeah. There's also ribbon microphones.
Yep. Yeah.
Or like $1,500 a piece.
Yep. There's really nice ribbon microphones. The condenser microphones are going to be the ones that if you have a quiet room, you can get some good sound. So let's talk about that because this is where my mind keeps going. Is the recording space itself. I think the biggest mistake people make at home is they have really loud room tone. I was struggling with this week on Coda Radio with Michael Dominic. You know, he's got a microphone, but he's also in a really bare room. And so it's just very echoey.
Yep.
And it sounds bad. It just doesn't sound very good. And there's not a lot you can do if the quality coming in is bad like that. There's some magic, but not a lot.
Garbage in, garbage out,
Everybody
as they
likes
say.
To pretend like you can twist some knobs on your mixer and take out the room tone. That's not a thing. if you've got room tone, it's going to be in the show, and it sounds amateur. It's like poor lighting in a YouTube video, right? Or bad framing.
At best, you'll be able to edit some of it out in post, but it will be a long process.
Right, then that's extra work for you.
And you might sound, the audio might come across sounding a little different after you're done.
Yep.
If you have the ability to build a booth around you, it doesn't actually have to be anything fancy. I've actually seen like people just, if they need to record a voiceover for a video, they'll put a moving blanket over them. And they'll just put it over their computer, and they'll put it over their microphone, and they'll just huddle under a moving blanket.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. I've known a podcaster, a very well-known podcaster, who moved to Texas. And for the first like 6 months, he ran his network out of his home bedroom closet. Because the closet was full of clothes and it had great sound.
That's actually something that a lot of the current at-home voice actors do now, too. The ones that can't afford to build a room, they just use a moving blanket and just huddle in a room and record lines.
Mm-hmm. So you could build, you could hang moving blankets around you. That's essentially what I did at Angela's house in the third garage. Is I just built a studio out of hanging moving blankets.
You could build a microphone shield box, pretty cheap.
Yeah, shield box is also really good, like a foam shield box that goes around the back of the microphone, so that way that's absorbing your talk instead of like the sound bouncing off a wall and coming back to the mic. If you can go as far as a booth, then you're really cooking with gas, because you could build a space that remains static between shows. That's where you get to appliance-level podcasting. You walk into this booth, everything's the same as it was the last time you did a show. Nothing's changed.
Sit down, start up, go.
You go. And creatively, that's how you want it, because every bit of energy and thought you spend on troubleshooting and setting up your audio is time and energy and thought you didn't spend on what am I going to talk about, what's the show about, what do we want to do this week, what would a perfect show look like. You're not thinking about any of that stuff. You're thinking about how to get your audio working. So that's why if you can have like a static space, a dedicated computer, a mixer, because the mixer knobs don't change, it just all becomes much more stable and reliable. And if you can build that into a booth, you set the computer outside, a little hole to come through, you put a screen in there, you put your mixer in there, you hang your microphone in there, you close the door, you're in show mode. You go outside, you're out, you're done. That's really the sweet spot. But that, you know, I couldn't build a booth. I don't have, it wouldn't even take much. It's what, a few walls and a roof? I couldn't do it. But I know there's people out there that have the means, and that would really be the sweet spot, because that space is not only going to sound great, but it's going to be dedicated to the task, which means it's going to be reliable.
Yeah, and if you can't build a booth, if you can dedicate a room, you can pad the room with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what we've done in here is we've dedicated this room to it, and we've just sound insulated the hell out of it. We have all kinds. You don't have to buy fancy sound insulation foam on Amazon. These top panels on the ceiling are actually fancy sound foam from Amazon, because I wanted a pattern, I wanted it to look decent. But the sound paneling on the wall is just painted egg crates. You just need something, and then they're on top of thick sound insulation foam. And that was just stuff I got from a family member in the hardware store. You know, this is like, this is only a couple hundred dollars of sound insulation total.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, any fancy material. You just need something that will disperse the sound instead of reflecting it.
That red curtain we have, so there's an extra doorway here in the studio, and there's a red curtain. That was the curtain I used to hang in my old home office when I was podcasting out of my home office at Angela's house. The room was it was a bare room when I moved in, just nothing but echo. So I hung curtains around the entire room. I put a curtain rod up, and I just, window or not, I just put curtains around the whole room. That red curtain, I had a whole bunch of them. And two things. One is it worked really well. I actually really liked the aesthetic of it because I could move the curtains around a little bit. But three, family members just assumed that my office was lined with windows. It was hilarious. They come over and they got a lot of windows in here. And I, of course, didn't have – the curtains are closed. So they just thought the windows were there.
Yeah, right.
But it worked fantastically. And the curtains themselves don't look bad on video. You know, you get a nice color or something like that if you end up doing video later on.
Oh, good point.
They don't look that bad. But that's only really can work if you can do it to the whole room. Or you could build a space around where you record at least.
Speaking of video, how do you do video on the cheap?
Well, I guess a cell phone? I don't know. You don't do video on the cheap. Not if you want good video. You don't really. I mean, so you're looking at probably $125 to $200 for the mixer. $70 to $200 for the mic.
I'd say $70 to like $400.
Yeah, depending on which mic you get, yeah.
Right.
Could be $100 for a good stand. For some reason, the stands and the spider mounts are like super expensive. But you know, for you, JB buys all that stuff. But for podcasters at home, or you know, for people that are doing shows like a, or they want to set up like a Twitch stream and they want to
right.
do a high production Twitch stream, you all the same gear would apply to that. You know, all this same stuff would work for doing a podcast, for doing a live stream, for recording an instructional video.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you're interested in doing content creation of any kind, a lot of the stuff will be reusable for other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big upfront cost, but it's stuff that can be repurposed into other things a lot of the time.
I'm going to link a guide to a eHome recording studio, and I'll link to the section too where they explain microphones because they do a much better job than I did, and that'll go right in the show notes. Read that, read through that, get an idea of what kind of microphone might work for you, and then go on to the Tube of Views and get some reviews. You'll find people that have pretty good voices, and they'll compare microphones right next to each other.
Well, I think eHome Recording Studio also has a section for that has like microphone shootouts where they do voice samples of different microphones.
Oh, cool!
With the same stuff. So you, because a lot of the thing with the microphone, it's not just you know you get a more expensive microphone, you get better quality. You can listen to these samples and figure out what kind of sound you like.
Yeah,
and then go get that microphone and try it out.
Yeah. Then later on, there's all kinds of cool things you can get, like foot pedals and all this kind of stuff that you can use to sort of you know, make yourself fancy. The thing with the mixers, the rabbit hole you can go down is they you can get mixers that do a lot of stuff. Like it's also a compressor.
Oh, right.
Which sort of evens your sound out. It's not compressor in like the MP3 sense, but it's compressor in the sound wave sense. And you can get a limiter, which will cut out some background noise when you stop talking. And that can be built right into the mixer. There's mixers that will record to a, like a thumb drive so you can have a local backup right there from a mixer backup.
Are those things worth exploring for people just starting out?
It depends. You know, it really depends on how you produce the show. If so some podcasts like to produce everything real time. So take like current iteration of TechSnap and like Linux Action Show, everything's done real time. And you want to get your audio mix as close to final as possible. Mm-hmm. So you want a real-time compressor. You want a real-time gate and limiter. You want to do all that kind of stuff because that's what ships in the final product. If you're doing a type of audio podcast where you're just recording and then later on it gets post-produced in editing, generally it's better to record with no effects and apply all of the effects in post because they can be applied evenly so they all match up.
Right.
And so it just kind of depends on how you're producing that show. And it is cheaper to do it in post because you can do it with software and you don't have to have real-time hardware. Like this mixer here can be like 17 pieces of equipment all at once. And it's great because even if we're going to edit and even if we're going to do a lot of post-production, it's like, well, why not kind of get the audio great? Like
right.
why not cut out some sounds, maybe, you know, have a gate in there so you don't hear somebody rolling around in their seat, things like that. Why not just have that if you can? So there's some reason to still have it. But if you're doing primarily post-production, you generally, you can almost just get away with the USB mic setup. But the more advanced you go, the better product you'll get in the end once you learn how to work it all.
Yeah, and there's other stuff you can get like hardware, compressors, limiters, and gates.
Mm-hmm. And there's YouTube videos that explain it all.
Yeah.
You know, you just start and then it's almost not worth worrying about what you don't know. Because you will figure out what you need to know as you go to solve the next problem.
And you probably, you know, as you're talking about like different shows, you'll naturally have different priorities of the next thing that's the most important to get right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny now, like what we consider what needs to be done right versus a few years ago even, because it's just totally different production requirements. There's totally different ways we edit and record now. And we've learned so many things about what it takes to get it right that it's like, you know, going back to our topic about rebooting TechSnap. It was a long time ago we started that show.
Yeah.
I was a totally different person back then. And now I've got a lot of years of experience under me. I would not launch the show the way. Like, if you go back and look at episode 1, 2, it is rough, rough, rough. We never should have done it that way, ever, ever. It's just awful. And lesson learned, right? You learn and do. And the same with podcasting as or live streaming, too, definitely. As you do it, you'll keep running into different technical hurdles. And at each time you'll go, is this something that's worth solving? What is it my, you know, and each time it's a chance to reevaluate what your product is, what it is you're making. And if that investment or if that challenge is worth it, or if maybe that's not the kind of product you want to make. Every major technical challenge is a chance to learn and a chance to evaluate what you're making. And sometimes you look at it and go, like recently with me, like it's not that I'm done vlogging forever, but I look at YouTube and I go, I don't want to play that clickbait game. And that's what you have. You have to put tits and ass in your thumbnail to get a lot of views when you're a new YouTube channel. And I don't want to make a product and then brand it with tits and ass just so that way I can get kids on YouTube to give me more views. Like, that's not...
You'll never believe what Hadiya does in this episode.
Right. And, or, you know, like Casey Neistat's famous for, like, he has 10 seconds or not even, like, 2 seconds of a girl on a beach, and that'll be his still. You know, and it goes by like that, but I was technically in the video.
It was
right?
in the video.
So, hey, it's not clickbait because it's technically in the... I just don't want to play that game. Homie don't want to play that game. And it's the same thing with how a lot of this stuff. Each time you look at it and go, is this a hurdle that I do want to... is this a challenge I do want to take on? Or is this something that right now is... I'm just going to keep making what I make and do it this way. And so I say, don't worry about if you don't know what a limiter is or a compressor is. You don't know what all these things do and what order they should go in and how they affect the final product. Because if you need to know, you will figure it out if you're going down this path.
Yeah. Going back to mixers for a second. When I was first getting my mixer, I was very overwhelmed by the wide array of options. But I figured out that a lot of the mixers are kind of the same thing, and the big differentiator between them is how many channels they have.
Yeah, yeah. What some of those features are. So like, sometimes there's definitely build quality differences. Yeah. But
I have my mixer is part of the Mackie Pro FX V2 series, and they have like the 4V2 and the 8V2 and the 12V2, and the only difference between those are the number of channels you want. And I wanted to say
nice.
That. Yeah. When you're getting a mixer, think about how many inputs you want. So how many microphones or whatever else you're going to plug into it. And then add like 3 or 4 because
yes.
You are always going to run out of spots.
Plus you'll be like, oh, so for stereo, I need to burn 2 of these? I mean, you do go through them pretty quick.
Yep.
Okay, one last plug. Like if you forget everything else we've talked about and you just follow one guide, check out Dan Benjamin's Podcast Method. podcastmethod.co. What I like about what Dan has done here is he's broken it up into a few sections. Now, it's a little out of date, but it's all pretty relevant because the hardware doesn't change that often. He's got it broken out into entry-level gear, intermediary gear, pro gear, and like at each stage is like significantly more cost, slightly change in features, but he has all the cost broken out. And then he has a mobile rig.
Oh.
And he also has a multi-person in-studio setup with, all the cost broken out, the devices he would use. I don't know if I agree 100% with all this stuff because, like, he's recommending, like, an Apollo Duo for an audio interface. That's a $2,000 audio interface.
Oh, boy.
A Focusrite for $300 would do the same job for that particular thing. But you look at this, you get a really good sense of the different kinds of tiers you can go in. So it's podcastmethod.co.
Sounds nice to kind of see some completed setups too, because I know that sometimes I get confused. It's like, well, I'm going to buy this, but I haven't played with it and I don't quite understand, is it going to work really well with this other component? And
yeah. Yeah, if you think it's a valuable guide, he's got a little donation link on there. You can check it out, podcastmethod.co. He runs the 5x5 Podcast Network and also Fireside, which is some of the back-end infrastructure we use for some of our shows. Let's do one more hashtag Ask Error. What product have you guys recently bought that made you feel like old men?
Well, I recently spent over $1,000 on UPS.
Oh, boy.
To ship stuff across the country.
For moving, yeah. Yeah, the whole thing of like going through housing, getting the credit for that, that makes you feel old, doesn't it? It's like all old people stuff. It's like,
I've also just recently put myself on the debt treadmill. And I got a credit card, Chris.
Oh, congratulations.
I'm becoming a true American adult.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, yeah. Congrats there, Rika. I'm sorry to hear that. What about you, Wes? Do you have anything that you've recently bought-ish, recently-ish, that makes you feel like an old man?
Well, I haven't bought it yet, but I'm on the hunt for a new comforter. And that definitely made me feel like an old man.
Oh my God, you're on the hunt, dude. You're on the hunt.
Well, I don't want to make a mistake. This is serious business.
So
it's winter now.
What?
I just realized that I did spend like 2 hours researching the most comfy pants I could find.
That is such an old man thing. All right, so here's my old man thing. And it was embarrassing because I got asked about it twice. So I go into Safeway. It's early one day here just about a week ago at the studio. And I'm like, I'm coming in an hour early today. I'm going to stop by the grocery store and I'm going to get myself some food items so I can eat good all week. Right there, it's starting to smell
yep.
a little old. I walk in there and it's early in the morning and nobody's in there except for me and apparently all of the Safeway employees. There is just employees all over the place, like as if there were shoppers in all the aisles. It's Safeway employees.
They're probably restocking.
Yeah, and scanning and checking and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm doing my thing. I go around, and I end up in the cheese and butter and egg aisle. And there's four Safeway employees and like a cart in the middle of the aisle, and they're all doing their business. So I walk in between two of them, and I'm looking at my item. And it comes over me. This is the first time I've ever bought this. I have no idea like what to look for, no idea how it's going to taste. And it's such an old person thing, I'm thinking to myself, right? And so I'm looking at the egg whites in the cartons, you know, the pre-beaten.
I was going to guess cottage cheese, but okay.
Yeah, the pre-beaten egg whites in like the little cardboard containers. And I'm looking at them, and there's a lot of different ones. There's like Santa Fe style.
What does that even mean?
So you whipped out your phone, and you're like,
no. No, I was so...
Overwhelmed?
Well... entrenched, like I was just really pulled in by all these egg options. Like there's so many egg. I had no idea what a business and industry this was. And I'm sitting there, I'm reading like garlic egg, Santa Fe eggs, egg whites only. And the Safeway employee says, "Sir, do you need some help?"
And
I
Could you repeat that, son?
I'm just getting egg whites. I'm buying egg whites. And he says, "Oh, okay." And I'm like, I'm just buying egg whites. And I don't know what to say because, like, I'm overwhelmed by this.
He snapped you out of your egg trance.
Yeah. And so I'm like, and then I'm looking at the brands, like, what is a good egg white brand? Who makes good eggs? How do I know which brand of eggs to get? And so that's going through my head. And another Safeway employee, sir, would you like some help? I said to him, I said, no.
I'm just looking at the eggs.
There's a lot of eggs. And I realize I've never had to make this decision before. I just need a moment.
So what did you go with? I have to know.
I just went with some basic eggs.
Not Santa Fe style?
He just broke down and sat on the floor and started crying.
It was rough, dude. It was touch and go.